Iranian singer's Grammy Award for his song honoring his nation's protest movement inspires people in Iran to denounce their Islamist rulers in a new way.
And then they use their player, bring the player on the window and play the Baraye song for others.
Plus, we'll ask the managing editor of Persian news site Kayhan London why some senior Iranian officials are acknowledging a need for change.
They do realize that the strength and the depth and resilience of this movement has not been able to fade away.
And later in the program, a U.S. researcher tells us how Tehran has been trying to intercept mobile communications of its people by seeking help from Western companies. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Iranian singer Shervin Hajipour has won a Grammy Award for a song he produced last year with lyrics drawn from social media posts in which Iranians stated what they were protesting for and because of. برای توی کوچه رخصیدن برای ترسیدن به وقت بوسیدن برای The U.S. Recording Academy honored Baraye with its first Song for Social Change Special Merit Award at Sunday's annual Grammy ceremony in Los Angeles, with U.S. First Lady Jill Biden making the announcement. Hajipour, who is based in Iran, celebrated with a simple message on his Instagram account saying, "We won." But on Tuesday, another message appeared, accusing the U.S. of taking away the happiness of Iranians. The message appeared to be part of Iran's practice of forcing its critics to make public statements in support of the government. With protest activity declining in Iran in recent weeks, I asked VOA Persian managing editor Arash Sigarchi what that means for the protest movement.
Michael, definitely I can say the number of the protests reduced. That's a fact. But the thing is, some days we have more, some days we have less. Let me give you an example. Iranian officials celebrate 10 days. They call Dahi Fajr, means 10 days before anniversary of the revolution. But that night, we had a lot of videos, more than 20 videos we received. People chanting, people were on their house, opened windows and chanting death to dictator, death to Islamic Republic, death to Ali Khamenei, Iranian supreme leader. And we can see that. And the thing is, some days the format of the protest changed. For example, Sunday night when Shervin Hajipour's song Baraye was chosen by...
You're talking about the Grammy Awards that happened on Sunday.
Yes. The night after was Monday night. People, again, in 10 locations in Tehran and some cities like Sanandaj, Isfahan, Shiraz, people, again, chanting against the regime. And then they use their player, bring the player on the window and, you know, play the Baraye song for others.
So obviously many Iranians were happy about the win of Shervin Hajipour of this special award issued by the Grammy Recording Academy for the first time this year. How would you describe the reactions that you've seen on social media to this achievement of Hajipour?
Honestly, it was huge for Iranian. Iranian had experience last 2-3 times. Farhadi, Iranian director, got the Oscar for his movie, but it was his movie. This time, an international award was for Voice of Iranian. Let me tell you how this song composed. Iranian started to say Baraye means because, for. Then they, when the protest started, they started to say a lot of, their wishes for the country, okay? For poor people, for bad economy, for not having freedom, and stuff like that. A lot of tweets. Mm-hmm. Shervin Hajipour just sit, collect them, made a poem, write a song with a mic, and produce this Baraye song, actually. And, it was people's vote. So that's why Iranians are so excited about this success. And let me tell you one interesting incident happened after the announcement.
Okay.
Let me give you a background about Shervin. Shervin Hajibabai was one of, talents who participate in Iranian version of the Got Talent show, which ran with Iranian IRGC groups. Okay, they had a show several years ago, and Shervin was in the show as a talent, and he was rejected. I saw a lot of reaction and compare with this award, Grammys, and that rejection from Iranian show in last several years ago, and many people mentioned that, hey, this is an iconic example how Islamic Republic kill your talent, but the world Grammys respect your work.
Right. Another example of Iranian talents being recognized more outside the country than by the authorities inside the country. Thank you very much, Arash Sagarchi, managing editor in VOA's Persian service. Always great to speak with you on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you so much for having me.
In recent days, senior Iranian officials have said action should be taken to resolve the country's social unrest, which they described as a weakness that Iran's enemies could exploit. Those speaking out included Iran's parliament speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf and judiciary chief Gholam Hossein Mohsen Ejei. What's behind the apparent calls for reform? I asked Nazanin Ansari, managing editor of news site Kayhan London, in a Monday phone call.
These statements are indicative of the realization of those within the political elite of the Islamic Republic of the depth of anger and frustration and resilience of the protest on the street level. They do realize that this is very different than 2015, 2016, 2017, that the strength and the depth and resilience of this movement has not been able to fade away or be shut down by mere crackdown. Indeed, when you look at a recent poll that was conducted between December 21st and December 30th, 2022, by the Netherlands-based Gamon Research, over 80% of them, of those 200,000 who had taken part in the poll, the Iranians inside the country and outside the country, they are intent that the Islamic Republic has to go. And 67% of them, they do believe that this movement is resilient enough to carry through. So Mr. Ghalibaf and Mr. Ejei, who have all the information and intelligence at their disposal, they cannot deny it. And obviously, they have to make these statements.
I'm curious to know if the Iranian president, Raisi, and even the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, would listen to these calls essentially for reform of the existing system, and if they would actually agree to do what their fellow conservative officials are saying they should do.
Well, Mr. Khamenei issued a PR statement that he will be pardoning prisoners, for example. Yesterday, he made such a statement. Obviously, all of these come with caveats. People who have been protesting, who have been arrested recently, they have to sign a very strong statement saying that they will not continue their protest. And if they do, the punishment against them would be even more harsh than before. And we already are receiving reports from Iran that many prisoners, they are so bold, they're not even willing to sign these statements. So, yes, the regime wants to as well show that it is in control, that the clampdown is working, and that's why they want to release and give pardon. These kind of pardons have always, these statements come from time to time. But when it comes to really following up and being able to see who has been released, how many people have been released, the statistics, the information is not available. So this mirrors how the Islamic Republic has behaved as far as its statistics, as far as its transparency, as far as its accountability. And so more than anybody else, it's the people inside Iran who are aware of this. They feel it.
So Mir Hossein Mousavi is a prominent opposition figure in Iran, and he also issued a call for change in recent days, but his statement seemed to go farther than what the current Iranian officials are talking about. What was interesting for you about what Mousavi said?
Well, as you know, Mr. Mousavi has been under house arrest and is still under house arrest. And whatever statement he gives has to be really monitored. He is under security guard all the time. And that is one thing we have to take into consideration. But what is noteworthy about Mr. Mousavi's message, a man that has represented the reformists, movement that has even paid a price by being with his wife under house arrest for so long. His message and his conclusion is that the people of Iran have given up on reforms, and reform from within is finished. Another reason Mr. Mousavi's statement is significant is that it goes into the heart of a layer of the society and the political elite of the Islamic regime, who were actually in 2009 were on the streets. And then they were sort of pushed aside by Mr. Ahmadinejad.
He was the president at the time.
The president who, quote unquote, according to the regime, won the elections. And that's after his election, Mr. Mousavi was put under house arrest and not allowed to speak. Mr. Mousavi has a lot of following in the security forces, in the Revolutionary Guards, and in the military. So there again, you see another crack within the heart of the system. But one more important point about the significance of the statement is that it echoes the calls by Prince Reza Pahlavi, in the sense that it asks for, first of all, human rights, Zan Zendegi Azadi, woman life freedom, which is, you know, a departure from before, where he was asking for the implementation of the Islamic Republic Constitution. Number two, he says the Constitution will have to be rewritten, and for that there has to be elections and referendum. And these mirror what actually Prince Reza Pahlavi and many others are insisting at this moment.
Nazanin Ansari, managing editor of Kayhan London and Kayhan Life, great to have you this week on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. U.S. media have reported in recent months that Iranian drones used by Russia to attack Ukraine contain Western-made components. What is the U.S. doing to stop Iran from obtaining those components? Last Friday, VOA's Syed Aziz Rahman put that question to John Kirby, U.S. National Security Council Coordinator for Strategic Communications.
We're always looking at options to try to limit the ability for nations like Iran to get their hands on U.S. technology. As you know, we have put many, many export controls in place specifically to limit the degree to which Iran and Russia can access U.S. technology. And you're right, there's a black market here. And so we're also in constant conversations with private tech companies about, you know, looking at safeguards to do the best we can to limit the proliferation of this technology. But let's not lose the forest for the trees here. There is a deepening, burgeoning defense relationship between Iran and Russia. Clearly, that relationship is not good for the Ukrainian people as Iran continues to provide drones that are killing innocent Ukrainian people and hitting civilian targets, and the regime in Tehran is responsible for that. But it goes the other way. The other thing we're concerned about is Russia providing military capabilities to Iran, because that will only further destabilize the Middle East.
That was National Security Council spokesman John Kirby. A report last month by the University of Toronto's Citizen Lab team found evidence that Iran has been trying to build a mobile phone surveillance system, with Western vendors potentially facilitating that project. The report said documents indicate firms based in Britain, Canada, and Russia had extensive discussions to provide support to the project, led by Iran's Communications Regulatory Authority, or CRA. I spoke by phone with Citizen Lab researcher Gary Miller and asked what Iran has been doing to legally intercept people's mobile communications.
Well, they do two things. You know, one is the development of an infrastructure, which the Iranian regime controls. And that infrastructure is technologically advanced. In other words, it does have, you know, capabilities broadly to do things across the board in terms of surveillance and control activities. And that type of infrastructure requires third-party support. You know, typically governments don't have, you know, the capabilities to do that on their own. So that's one, and that requires, you know, software expertise, which we know Iran has. Two is within mobile operators, mobile network operators and mobile service providers, they also look to outside vendors in order to build an infrastructure, right, to support their services. And that infrastructure, we've found that they rely, you know, on these vendors in order to provide the capabilities that the Iranian government requires of all these communication service providers. So it really is, you know, from vendor to mobile service provider to the Iran CRA, really there is a role that each of them plays in order to provide, you know, this type of system to the government regime.
Well, your report did find that some of those vendors are actually Western companies. What did you learn about how those Western companies ended up getting involved in this project, and what have they had to say about it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, these vendors, you know, whether they be Western-based companies or they be based in Europe, I mean, we know that, you know, their job is to operate a business. And some of them are willing to take the risks, you know, in working with, you know, Iranian companies. And it's a huge risk, but they're willing to take that risk in order to do large, you know, multimillion dollar deals. And we found that, you know, despite the inherent risks and the efforts that they take to hide some of those communications, which we did expose in the report, they're willing to do that regardless. And really, there's really no excuse, you know, that I can see that they could say, well, there's a rogue person trying to do sales deals. I mean, you know, any large deals do get notified by the executives, you know, at these various companies. So there's really little excuse, you know, in my opinion. And, you know, we found that in that dialogue, they were very desperate to, you know, go immediately to lawyers, right, and attorneys, and respond to it. But, you know, these are just, you know, really attempts to try to suppress the information that we, you know, at Citizen Lab are trying to, you know, expose this type of activity and provide a level of transparency that's really needed in order to kind of stop, you know, these companies from furthering, you know, the regime's objectives.
Well, when you talk about lawyers getting involved, do you mean that the vendors consulted with lawyers when Citizen Lab contacted them about their work with Iranian companies?
That's correct. Yeah, they immediately responded. And we did provide, you know, the letters and the communication, you know, within that report. And you can see, you know, actually the dialogue back and forth. And that's, you know, it's important for people to understand, you know, the way that, you know, these companies operate when, you know, this type of activity is exposed. You know, they do try to stop it, right, and try to scare you. But, you know, it's important, you know, for us to get this information out and you know, and do it in such a way that, you know, people really understand that there's a separation of the technology to the impact, you know, of people. And that's one of the objectives that we had when we built this report, did the research and investigation, and, you know, and ultimately, you know, exposed the story and provided it.
Is there any chance that these companies are actually violating U.S. sanctions when it comes to doing business with Iran?
You know, clearly there was communication with outside parties, right? And we saw, you know, through that investigation that there were attempts to funnel, you know, commercial activity, you know, through a third party. Whether or not, you know, this system was actually deployed by these vendors, we don't know for 100%, and we can't say. But, you know, there are, you know, indications that there were very advanced, you know, discussions on the commercial side. So the question of, you know, whether there was attempts to evade sanctions and whether those sanctions were violated is really something that, you know, requires, you know, each country that, you know, has these sanctions in place, such as the U.S., you know, really needs to do their due diligence. You know, what I can tell you is that there was a lot of interest, you know, in this report, you know, across the board, not just, you know, from the journalism community, but other communities as well. And I think it really takes time to determine whether that is in fact the case. And that's really up to, you know, the Treasury Department of the U.S. to determine that.
And when you say other communities, do you mean also, you know, U.S. government officials, for example?
Well, I can tell you that this report has been read by, you know, multiple different agencies. You know, we do know that. You know, I can't tell you that, you know, there have been, you know, discussions, because I have not been party to them. But, you know, I can tell you that, you know, what that report did is it opened up, you know, that dialogue. And we have been engaged by multiple, from NGOs, you know, to, you know, other researchers, to activists, all different types of communities that are concerned about what is happening in Iran, and, you know, the role that these vendors and the mobile service providers play a role in that particular activity. I would expect, you know, some movement to happen on that, some more research, and probably some more stories that come out of that. I can't tell you with any specifics, but the level of interest that we received, you know, indicates that there will be, you know, some more investigation.
Since this report came out, have you seen any signs in the recent weeks that Iranian authorities are, you know, moving forward with this plan to build a mobile network surveillance system? Or, you know, is there any indication that maybe they're thinking twice about this now that the word is out, so to speak?
Well, what I can tell you is that that infrastructure already exists. It's actually, Michael, it's been out for a number of years. And in that communication, we've seen that, you know, after the launch of that network, there was dialogue. So there's no doubt that that infrastructure is currently in place.
But is it being used?
Well, I think there certainly is evidence, right? I mean, even since that report has been released, I've had people reach out to me that, you know, they've seen and they've witnessed, you know, activity that indicates that, you know, that this level of visibility does exist. For example, you know, that, you know, mysterious, you know, people knocking on the door and wanting to, you know, look at their mobile phones, right, and make arrests and interrogate people. We do see direct evidence of that. Now, how does the regime, you know that, you know, this particular person is using, you know, a VPN on their phone, right, or taking videos? That requires, you know, a digital infrastructure in order to, you know, surveil, perform some reconnaissance activity, you know, and ultimately identify, you know, individuals that, you know, present a risk. So, you know, are they using it? I think the evidence, you know, it really speaks for itself. You know, we don't see indications directly that they're using, you know, these different API commands and this type of thing, but we do know what's happening on the ground. And I have heard of, you know, some horrible stories of interrogations and people being taken as a result of it.
Well, it sounds troubling, but Gary Miller, a mobile security researcher at Citizen Lab, joining us from Seattle. Please do keep us posted on your research on this topic, and thanks for being with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Well, thanks for having me, Michael.
That's it for this week's show. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Glad you could join me, and please do so again next week for another Flashpoint Iran.